Hey guys, welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Welcome back. Hope everyone is having a good fall. Oh, I guess it's not quite fall yet. I think in a couple of days it will be fall, but having a good September, back to work, back to school. We actually just celebrated 1 year of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? So happy birthday to us. And again, thank you so much to all of you for continuing to listen and subscribe, and to all of our amazing, wonderful guests, wonderfully talented, very inspiring individuals from all aspects of the music industry who come on the show each week to talk about their career trajectory, their love of music, the obstacles they face, the trials and tribulations, all the good stuff, just great advice and insight that they've shared along the way. So just very grateful for an entire year's worth of that. All the podcasts are actually up on the website, musicjobspodcast.com, starting with the very first podcast episode. So you can go on back and listen to that, or you can listen to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android. We're also on TuneIn. So if you are on one of those sites, please like, subscribe, share, tell your friends, give us some stars, show us some love. We always love to get little stars and get up in the rankings so we can spread the word and tell more and more people about this podcast, all about careers in music, and to help those people that are wondering, you know, how do I get a music job? How do I start my career in music? How do I get into the music industry? What does it take to get into the music industry? So last week we had the wonderful Anthony Citrinitti, or Ant C. He's an incredible drummer. He has actually just launched an app called Meethook, M-E-E-T-H-O-O-K. It's a music networking and tutorial, like, you know, it's for students, it's for fans, it's for people looking for professional musicians. It's a really great app. So he talks all about that in his last episode. So go on back and check it out if you haven't heard it already. And now my next guest is Simon Tam. And what I would say when I refer to Simon is I would think of him as a music thought leader. He is the founder of The Slants, the world's first all-Asian American dance rock band. He's an author. He's an entrepreneur. He is a podcaster. He has been featured, or his work at least has been featured, in nearly every media outlet you can think of. He is a man who never sleeps. So he's going to talk to us all about his music journey, his journey as an entrepreneur, which started out at age 13, and so much more. But first, here's a track from The Slants. This is our featured track, 1821. Here we go. In the watchful eyes, they all misjudge. One day they'll see. You were 18, now you're 21. Drew their lines and they changed their minds. You were 18, now you're 21. Housed by rules, now you're free to run. You were 18, now you're 21. Drew their lines and they changed their minds. You were 18, now you're 21. Housed by rules, now you're free to run. You were 18, now you're 21.
Hey Simon, thank you for joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Me too. And I'm very grateful you could make the time, because if anybody Googles Simon, you will see what I'm talking about. So let's start off with childhood. I always love to hear about the first impressions, the first experiences of music. So maybe just talk about, you know, what's your first memory of music? What kind of household did you have growing up in terms of music?
Yeah, my first memory of music is actually something that I don't actually remember, but I have it on an old, like, family home video. And that's of me, I think I'm about 2 or 3 years old, where I'm grabbing an acoustic guitar, I think it's my dad's, and I jump up on the coffee table and start playing it and shouting and pretending I'm playing a show in the middle of the living room. Like, before I even, like, was fully comprehending what was going on, that was, like, in my head what I thought was music. And then as I kind of got a few years older, instead of playing games like tag or hide and go seek with my family, I would get my younger sister and my two younger cousins, and we would play band. So I would get stacks of newspapers and magazines and spread them out on the floor like it was a stage. And then we would just bang pots and pans and grab toy pianos and guitars and just start screaming at the top of our lungs, because obviously that's what rock stars do. So we thought we're being very accurate in that depiction.
And I love it.
And those were kind of like my earliest memories. Even though my family wasn't necessarily artistic, they definitely didn't encourage me to go into music for like a possible career. They wanted me to do the traditional thing, like a doctor or a lawyer. But it was something that I knew that my dad loved. Like, he used to make these mixtapes of songs and then sing over them like it was karaoke and send them to my mom. And like in between the songs, he would be like, you know, professing his love for her and things like that. So like, I grew up wherever we went, whenever my mom was driving, she would listen to those tapes. Like, she held on to them. And she actually, 30 plus years later, she still listens to them in her car. Like, aww, that's how much she treasures it. And I just always remember, like, wow, if music could be that powerful and create that kind of special memory in our family, like, there's something to it.
Yeah, I love that story. That's beautiful. So your parents don't necessarily want you to pursue a music career. So walk us through a little bit about like high school and looking towards college. What was kind of your mindset then?
So I had a lot of different interests, but I would say since the age of 10, like that's when I started taking formal lessons on bass guitar, I just absolutely loved it. And I couldn't imagine myself not being involved with music somehow. So at age 13, I started my first record label and would put on shows and raise money for charities using music. I would put out records from different local acts, as well as do merchandise design and printing for them. So I would actually ride around town on my bicycle and put out these like pamphlets, like flyers for my company at different record shops, and bands would just contact me and I would start working with them. Some of them end up becoming like pretty large acts, like Payable on Death or POD was one of the first acts that I worked with. So that was kind of like in my mind. And then as I graduated college and as I graduated high school and I started going towards college, me and my best friend Perla, we opened up our own vintage clothing store just about 40 minutes from our college in this historic old town Temecula. And there we would, for fun, put on shows, because we were like, well, we love shows, we have this space, let's just throw them at night or have them in our parking lot or whatever we can use this space for. So that's how I kind of stayed involved with that. And then as I was putting on shows for these bands, a lot of them, especially from like 70s punk bands, would love working with us. They just, because they were so frustrated by booking agents and talent buyers who didn't care. They, like, so groups like TSOL, the Dickies, you know, Marky Ramone's musicians, they would always like contact us asking us to book their tours or shows for them. So that kind of continued on as like a side hustle for me. And it was really truly a labor of love. Like, we would, as we put on shows for bands, we would personally go to the hotels we would book for them and investigate the rooms, making sure that it was like that we would want to stay there. And then we would make home-cooked meals for the bands every time they came into town, so that they didn't have just, you know, like pizza and beer, like, but they had something nourishing. Like, that was the kind of thing I wanted to do for acts. I just imagined, like, hey, if I was on the road, how do I want to be treated? And how can I make sure to take care of other people whenever I work with them?
So let's back up a little bit, because I want to hear more about this 13-year-old starting a record label.
Yeah.
So where do you think you got the confidence and the fearlessness to start your own record label, to become an entrepreneur? And also, to piggyback on that, did you teach yourself, or were there people around that were helping you, teaching you?
It was a bit of both. I think it was, part of it was just I was kind of pretending. It was almost like fake it till you make it. I would just say I have a label, and then bands started contacting me, and I was like, oh, I better step it up now.
I better do this.
Yeah, because I wanted to make sure that I didn't let them down. And part of it was also I grew up in a family that had businesses in order to survive. My parents owned a restaurant. My uncle on my dad's side had a handyman service. On the other side of the family, like my mom's siblings all had their own businesses. Like they were always doing something, like some kind of hustle to survive. So I think that's where that initial drive came from. And then as I started, you know, going into high school, I would look for mentors, leaders who I was, you know, really into their work, or people who could help me with that kind of thing. And so a lot of them would recommend books to me. And one of the books that profoundly impacted me at that age was this book called Developing the Leader Within You by John C. Maxwell. Hmm. And it was my first leadership book that I ever read, but I was blown away by it. And so at that time, I was like, you know what? From here on out, for the rest of my life, I'm going to read at least two books or magazines or digest two sources on leadership, marketing, or sales every single month for the rest of my life. And that's how I started this leadership library that I still have at home now. And those books oftentimes have the same principles about taking initiative, of learning how to create an identity, how to lead. And I would use all those principles in whatever projects I started taking on, including that record label when I was 13. I just was kind of in this mindset that was started by one of those mentors who told me, he said, Simon, there are three kinds of people in this world: those who wait for things to happen, those who make things happen, and those who wonder what the heck just happened. And he said, be someone who makes things happen. So I was like, okay, like I just basically have permission here to try. And at the very worst, you know, the worst thing that can happen is I fail. But if I learn something from that failing moment, I can at least pick up the pieces and do better the next time around.
That's great. I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think it's really important for people to understand that, especially as we were discussing a little earlier, being an artist today requires you to essentially be a leader in this industry. So let's go back to college, and you're working with bands. Are you playing in bands? Are you actively doing music? What about that aspect?
So while I was in college, I was not playing in any bands. I was still playing bass, and I would get involved with like local churches and that sort of thing. And I would also kind of step in as a fill-in player for different bands that would come through town, but I wasn't like an active performer. And it wasn't until about 2 months before graduating college, I was about to graduate on a double major program from this like prestigious program on philosophy and religious studies and intercultural communication, when I got the call from one of those bands that I would book shows for. And They basically said, hey, we were in the middle of our national US tour. We just kicked our drummer out. Do you play drums? And I said, well, I just started taking lessons 2 weeks ago, but I don't think I could play well enough to help you out on this tour. Because they're like, we're in Missouri right now. We'll come and pick you up right now. But I was like, okay, if I do this, I'm actually going to make a really bad impression. So I was like, let's wait. If you need to cancel your tour, you cancel it, but like check back with me in 6 months. So they called me up 6 months later after I had been, you know, really practicing and taking lessons and everything else, but I didn't feel confident in that. And I told them like, hey, I'm not a drummer. I'm a bass player. Like that's what I've been playing for most of my life and I love it. And so what they decided was because they saw my work ethic and because they loved how I treated them on tours, they're like, you know what? Our bass player is going to move to guitar and we want to have you as our bassist. So come up to Portland and we'll find a drummer. So that's what I did. I decided to drop out of college and move up to Portland, Oregon. And that's where I kind of joined my first full-time touring band in that time period. So it was my early 20s.
Wow. Did your family freak out?
Surprisingly not. I mean, my whole life I was really, really pressured about, you know, having good grades, and my parents really wanted me to be that first person to graduate from college in our family, but they saw how unhappy I was as well. And so they basically provided me with their blessing and I moved. And I just promised them, I was like, you know, one day I'll go back to school, I'll finish, but I got to do this thing now because this opportunity might not come around again.
And I love the fact too that, you know, you kind of stuck to your guns, because I know there's the whole narrative about, you know, when your opportunity comes, you jump at it. But the fact is your opportunity came a couple times, but you ultimately said, look, this is who I am. I'm a bass player. I would love to be a drummer for your band, but where my talents lie, who I am, is a bass player. And what happened was, is that they made arrangements so that you could actually do that, as opposed to you compromising your own belief system or wherever you want to call it and trying to be something you're not, basically.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of power in being confident with who you are and knowing what you have and what you're most passionate about. Because if you compromise that, I think either one, you'll disappoint people. Like if I went up there as their drummer, they're gonna be like, wow, this guy isn't that great of a drummer. We could do a lot better by actually having someone who's a drummer. Plus I wouldn't be happy, and like that's important as well. But I think there's also this kind of testament, like this is who I am, and if you bring me on as your bass player, you get all these other benefits. Like I am deeply involved with the music industry, been doing booking for, you know, since I was a teenager. Like I can do all this stuff for you as well, and they just kind of sense that, and because I had been building that relationship up, I wasn't trying to advance myself or sell myself to them all the time. Like they just saw that, hey, this guy's, you know, really good to us. Let's go ahead and return that favor.
Yeah, that's great. And that shows too how being of service can actually get you a lot farther than sort of like endlessly self-promoting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there's this old quote by a sales guru named Zig Ziglar. And he said that you can get everything in life that you want if you help enough other people get what they want. Like at the end of the day, that's what sales is. It's giving people a product or service that they need. And if you do that for enough people, well, then you're going to have all of the resources you could ever imagine. So it's the same kind of thing. Like I figure if you just keep giving value to other people, the universe will give it back in return in some kind of way.
That's great. Okay, so now you're a rock star in Portland. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I started playing and touring with the band. It was called The Stivs, and I had a great time. Like, these were my friends. I didn't know anybody in Portland, so I would just hang out with them all the time and be constantly working on the band. We started getting quite a bit of momentum. We had an indie label put out our album. We worked with the producer Jack Endino, who worked on, you know, seminal records for Nirvana, the Murder City Devils, and Soundgarden. So things are like going really well, and I'm just booking a ton for the band. But I start getting really frustrated because the band starts, well, they start taking advantage of the fact that I'm in it and taking it for granted. So they would just, Some of the band members would show up to shows just totally hammered. And it really frustrated me because I was like, you don't appreciate what I do, like how much I'm putting in to get us these shows. And when you show up really drunk like that, not only is it like frustrating because the show is awful, but it's a terrible example for like the all-age kids that we're playing for. So I decided that I had enough of that and that I wanted to start my own project, which worked out fine because at the same time, I had this idea to start a band that would provide some representation for the Asian American community, which I'm a part of, something that is largely absent in the entertainment industry. So I thought, you know, why not do this cool 80s sounding band that could kind of pay homage to the music I grew up with, and at the same time, provide a little bit of representation for this unheard community. And that project eventually became The Slants, which is my main band even to this day.
So tell us about that. Tell us how you went about forming that band and, you know, what it took to become a popular band in the industry.
So with this band, I knew it was special. Like I believed in the idea of the band before I had anyone else a part of it. And in doing so, I knew I didn't want to compromise. I didn't want to go through the same situation again of having people who wouldn't really truly appreciate what we were doing. So I made sure from the very beginning that whenever I auditioned people for the band, that I was extremely strict about it. Like, it wasn't just about musical ability. It was also about personality. It was about understanding what it took and people who would be willing to kind of make whatever sacrifices were needed and who had something to offer in terms of joining the band. And to this day, I still do. So my current band members laugh and joke about how I have this really rare audition process where I have an application that people have to fill out on our website.
Oh, wow.
It has like multiple choice answers and short essay questions as well, asking them about their background, their mindset, like all kinds of stuff like that, because I wanted to make sure it was like a really, really good fit. And that was before people even got to play a single note of one of our songs. So that kind of process of making sure, okay, I got the right people involved. But thankfully, like, I took 2 years seeking people out. And finally, when I had enough of a lineup together, this was in late 2006, early 2007, it took off from the get-go. So our first show was May 31st, 2007. And within a few weeks, we were already on TV in Japan. Within 3 months, we had our first album out, and we had endorsement deals with Fender, with Seymour Duncan, with like about 15 major music instrument companies. And like, we weren't even on tour yet. We weren't even signed. They just knew what we were doing was really special and they wanted to be a part of it.
Basically, that was because of the footwork you did prior to actually coming out with music.
Yeah. So I believe preparation is key. And with this particular band, I started out with a very specific set of goals. So I wasn't just going to like put together a band, played some shows to see what would happen. My idea was, okay, these are the things that I want to achieve. This is what I want to do for my community. Like, I want to sell this number of records. This is how often I want to be playing shows. And then I started creating a plan to work towards that. So before I even had anyone else in the band, I was ready to launch this thing as if it were a real business and they were going to be my future employees or contractors. So when I did have that band, when I had that first show booked, I already was ready to spring everything else into plan. Like, it actually shocked my band members because I was like, okay, we had our first show, now let's start recording our album. And they're like, we only have 6 songs. And I'm like, no, we're going to have the songs by then. Like, this is how many songs we need to write per week. Here's a buffer. You know, we need it done by this date because that's our first big break for a show. Like, I booked this convention that we were playing at that I knew was going to be a really key show for us. And it ended up being great because we sold 1,000 records that one show. And wow. I basically sold enough merch to pay for our tour bus, our first run of merch, and to basically from that point on tour without worrying about a single cent again.
That's amazing. So just for in terms of logistics, that 2 years that you were working on promoting the band, how did you yourself earn an income? I think that's always sort of a question of like, how do you support your art when your art isn't exactly supporting you in that moment?
So I did have a job at that time. I was managing a drywall tool store. So it wow. was like my kind of my main hustle at the time since I wasn't active. But I would say about a year after I launched the Slants, I was able to leave full-time work and just go straight into music. So like, I knew it was about the potential. I just didn't have the ability to launch it quite yet. So what I was doing was using every minute outside of my job to basically run the business of the band. And that included everything from setting up the website to the social media to lining up shows before I even had a single song recorded. Like, I would get commitments from people, basically selling them on the concept of the band. And they just loved the idea so much that a lot of them were willing to bank on it and book shows for me, like really high profile slots, even though I didn't have any band members yet.
Do you mind going into a little bit of detail about that? Like, how you were able to effectively sell your band without even having, you know, a first single out?
Absolutely.
How were you able to successfully market yourself like that?
So I really focused on niche marketing. For example, with the Slants, I always said we were an Asian American band or all Asian American band. So I would focus on markets that really catered towards that market or who wanted to reach it and somehow. So for example, I started booking anime conventions, like these fan conventions around the country that oftentimes will be attended by between 3,000 and 20,000 kids. So they have very, very large budgets. And I would just say, hey, you need more live programming. I have this band, I want to play there. And the funny thing is, I didn't have a band. I actually took photos of my favorite actors from Hong Kong movies and photoshopped them into my band shows and pretended
that it was a band.
And I just and I was like, we're recording our album now. But in the meantime, you have the opportunity to help be one of the first events to break this band to like,
wow.
And they were just like, what? We get to be the first? Like, yeah, we want to be a part of this. And so I would book these gigs that basically paid for all of our first endeavors. And that was just being very, very specific about it. Because if I was just targeting like mid-sized venues or, you know, the Vance Warped Tour, they'd be like, you're crazy. Like, where's your band? Where's your music? But I was going specifically for events that didn't traditionally have music, but I knew would be really, really interested in what I was doing. So when I reached out to them and I showed how it would be a perfect fit with whatever they had going on, they were excited by it.
That's great. And I'm assuming you've read Blue Ocean Strategy because you're like a case study out of that book.
I haven't, no.
It's essentially what you're talking about. It's looking for underserved markets, like getting out of the red ocean where everybody's competing for smaller and smaller audiences and finding blue oceans, untapped, underserved markets. They give an example of like Cirque du Soleil coming out of the Barnum and Bailey monopoly of circuses and how Cirque du Soleil tapped into this completely different adult contemporary audience. So like I said, again, you're like the perfect case study for that because you weren't just in that red ocean just trying to get big venues that were showing all the big rock acts or whatever. You were like, we're going to go into the markets where nobody knows about it yet.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's always been about these kind of niche markets because I think there's number one, there's less competition. But number two, if you tap into people who have similar values than you, then of course they're going to be excited about what you're doing. And so we actually, for the first 2 years or so, we really made our career off of playing anime and video game conventions. They would be my anchor shows on tours. So
that's brilliant. And this is back in the 2000s, right? This is
2007, 8, 9.
That's brilliant. It's so brilliant.
You think about this, like our country was going through one of the worst recessions in history. Yet I was still making a full-time living as a performer. And
wow.
Because of these conventions, I was staying at like 4-star resorts 3 nights of the week. Of course, the rest of the 4 nights, I was like couch surfing and sleeping on floors. But for 3 days, we had great showers, humongous stages. I mean, I'd play for like 10, 15,000 people at a time. And then I'd go back and sell a ton of merchandise, then play venues for like 30 to 100 people. But because I was playing these large venues, if we toured on a regular basis, like whenever we did follow-up shows, we would take a chunk of those audiences and bring them with us to our music venue shows. So that made promoters really excited as well. I mean, the first major story on our band was on NPR's All Things Considered, and they were talking about how we were building this geek army up because no one else was doing this. And even now, it's kind of funny that it's been a little bit over a decade. We've done over 200 of these events. So played more of these conventions than any band in the entire world. And the deeply ironic thing is that we have nothing to do with anime. Like, we don't have an anime theme song. We don't play covers of anime. Yet, we are the most in-demand anime act in the world.
Wow. That's incredible. So what happens as this is going along, because you obviously are, as I said, if you Google Simon, you'll see there's a lot of other things that are going on in your life. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like going into the next decade, like where were your, what was your mindset on? What was your vision? What were your goals? That kind of thing.
So as I was really kind of gearing up and getting busy with the band, a lot of times I would run into these other artists and they would always ask me like, how did you get Fender? Or how did you get like whatever amp company? Like, they were always asking how I got a certain sponsorship. And so I would tell them, I've always been happy about sharing whatever it is that I have to share. And that only led to more emails. And I'm like, man, I'm tired of getting these emails. So I started writing articles, both for Music Think Tank, and then I started a blog on my own website called Last Stop Booking, and writing articles about how to get sponsorships. That, of course, led to even more emails, like a couple hundred a week. So I combined all those articles together and decided to publish my first book, which is How to Get Sponsorships and Endorsements. And because of the kind of built-up demand over the years, it debuted as a bestseller in the music industry and art business categories on Amazon. And nowadays, like when people ask me about sponsorship, I'll just send them like a kind of a canned email saying, hey, thanks for writing me. If you're interested in the topic, here's a link to my blog. There's over 200 free articles on sponsorship. If that's not enough for you, you can buy the book. The digital version is $4. And if that's not enough for you, you can set up an appointment and I will do a personal consultation session with you. So that's how I started getting into music business consulting work. I started booking tours for other bands and doing more and more writing in the industry. And at the same time, my band also started getting involved with this really high profile legal case that was where we were fighting against the United States Patent and Trademark Office over the right to register our band's trademark. That eventually, you know, took up the next 7 years of my life and eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court as well. So lots of big projects at this time period while I was still, you know, touring and releasing albums and that sort of thing.
How did you manage all of this? Like, how were you able to kind of keep so many plates in the air and stay focused and still feel like you're an artist and a creator?
I like to tell people I don't have kids and I don't have Netflix. So, like, those are the two biggest time wasters, right? Or not wasting it. Like, I mean, if you have a family, obviously that's very important. But like, I didn't have the traditional distractions that people would have. I didn't have TV. I just figured, okay, instead of wasting 4 to 6 hours a night on TV, which is the average American's consumption of television, what if I instead invested that directly into the music industry? And I still do this about 2 to 4 hours a day. I do research. I learn about specific skill sets that I think are important for the next steps. I look at trends in terms of marketing and social media. I digest all of that. And then I spend about 2 to 4 hours a day executing on those ideas. So, for example, if I hear about some interesting tactics on Instagram or YouTube or something like that, I'll just go ahead and apply it, start creating content and seeing how that works out. So that was a lot of kind of the biggest chunk of my day. I would also try and find ways to leverage whatever existing time I had. So, for example, if I was eating lunch, I didn't want to just be sitting there eating lunch mindlessly. I'd be very thoughtful about it and either jot down lyric ideas or I would just work on a plan for an upcoming tour. You know, I just try and make the most of it, or I would kind of leverage it in terms of always trying to book an appointment and speaking with somebody like a local business owner about what they're doing and seeing if I could partner up with them in some kind of way. At the same time, when I was on the road, we always took turns driving. So I developed this idea of like having everybody take on assigned driving shifts. So everybody in my band drives. We all have a 3-hour shift. We know the exact driving order. So what's nice about that is that you only have to end up driving about every 2 days. The rest of the time you get to just ride. So we set up our own private network and I would just do work from the road, either continuing to do more work on the industry or booking tours for other acts.
And then what about in terms of creating? How do you keep an open space to create? Do you know what I mean? Where you don't have to be doing anything.
So for any kind of activity, whether it's creating or writing, like, you know, an article or something like that, I'd basically book appointments for myself. Like I'd put them into my calendar and that was my commitment to my art. Like I would never compromise that time unless there was like a family emergency or something like that. So if, you know, for some people that is like their the equivalent of their date night or their, you know, the football game is on. They absolutely have to watch it. No one else can bug them during this time period. For me, it's like if I was creating, nobody was going to get in the way of that. If someone wanted a meeting, if someone wanted to interrupt me, they better have a really, really good reason, or I would just make them work around it, which most of the time people were willing to do.
That's a great point. I like that. It's like a you know, absolute commitment and not allowing anything else to get in the way of that. So as we've continued into this decade, almost nearing the end of this decade, and it seems like there's so much more, I mean, compared to 2007, 2008, there's so much more noise. There's so much more information. There's so many more apps. There's so many more platforms. So how do you, as an entrepreneur, as a creator, how do you continue to make an impression, to continuing to innovate, to be at the forefront? Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So I think there's always been quite a bit of noise. We just tend to have more access and more channels these days. But I think what cuts through all that clutter is value. And more importantly, what's valuable to a very specific audience. So if a person is just trying to be Instagram famous or they're just trying to go viral, a lot of times people see through that. And even if they have something that, you know, ends up doing pretty well, they'll disappear very quickly. Like if you want to have lasting power, if you want to build a sustainable career, you have to be consistently providing value to people. And so that's something that I have been working on from, I would say for most of my career, I've always thought about like, what can I do to make more people happy? What can I do to provide value to other people in a unique or different kind of way? And how can I make sure to do it consistently? Like those, I would say just doing those two things without knowing anything about social media, without knowing anything about booking or anything else like that, like will drive the activities that will get you there. So for example, just this year, I decided to launch my own podcast, mostly just because I thought it would be fun to do. And I was like, you know, everyone's doing like a podcast. Why don't I try doing one on the music business and have it kind of loosely based off one of my books called Music Business Hacks, which is really catered around like being very, very tactical. Like here are, you know, steps 1, 2, and 3, what you need to work on each day for your career. So I thought if maybe I could leverage this into a show. And then I thought, what's something that I could do that's really different than the other kind of music business shows out there besides being tactical? And I was like, well, there's no one else is doing a daily show. So why don't I just do a daily show, which at some points I'm very proud of and other points I'm really frustrated because I have to record and produce a show every single day.
Yeah, my God.
But I'm like, you know, I just got to go ahead and do this because I, you know, the biggest complaint I get from artists that I work with whenever people contact me is like, how do you have the time? Like, do you sleep at night? That's always the question I get asked. And I'm like, you can always find time for the things that are important to you. Like whether it's waking up a little bit earlier, whether it's skipping out on, you know, the newest Game of Thrones episode, whatever it is, like you just figure out a way to make it happen. So that's what I decided to do with this show. And I originally was like, if I get 10,000 people to listen, like in a year, I'll be happy. And that would just be a fun little experiment that I did over 365 episodes or something like that. And I just kept doing it and like doing it. And very few people were listening for the first like month or two. And then all of a sudden, word started getting around and more people listened to it. Then I would do a speaking appearance here and there and people would get turned on to the show. And so now it's been about 7 months since I started this show and I've already quadrupled my year goal, already past 40,000 listeners. So I'm like, wow, like all I had to do was show up. And like I hardly promote this show. Like I, you know, send a tweet out at 7 a.m, which is a terrible time to tweet, by the way. But that's when I post my show. And I just figure if people really like it, they'll share it. And if they don't, then that's my bad. I need to be doing something. I need to step it up and do something that people are eager to share. Mm-hmm. And it's worked out really well. I think Seth Godin, who's like this marketing guru and author and thought leader that a lot of people enjoy, kind of did the same kind of thing. He would vlog every single day, and he's done it consistently for 7 years. And every day he makes sure it's something pithy that's interesting, insightful, that maybe someone will like. He also, like, for the longest time, didn't have Twitter or any social, yet he has the number one blog in the world. So it, you know, showing up every day and making sure it's something of value to your audience, well, that goes a long way.
That's great. I'm wondering also if you can talk a little bit about your music in relation to all these different projects, because I think one of the fears that artists have is, if I'm putting out all these different projects, they're going to forget I'm a musician. They're going to forget I'm an artist. The fan base for my music is going to fall away. What's been your experience with that?
I think people worry too much about that. It's like they worry too much about their brand, so to speak. Like, well, if I do this, right, then I'm not going to be known for that, or something like that.
Yep.
But I always kind of push back and say, okay, what is a department store known for? Like, if you go to a Macy's, like, well, they sell clothes, but they also sell makeup. They also sell home goods. There's, like, all kinds of things. And they somehow can manage all of that at the same time while just building up their overall brand of who they are. Like, people just know, oh, that's a Macy's, or that's, you know, whatever store it is. Amazon does the same thing. They sell, like, a billion different things, yet people somehow find their way there each day. Artists can do the same thing and say, you know what? Not only are we a source of music, but we can also be a source of these other goods, writing, you know, videos, whatever content that you want to create that you're passionate about. We know there's also, like, Childish Gambino is also a comedian, Donald Glover. Like, there's no problems there. Like, people can be more than just one thing. We're complex beings, and artists most of the time are exceptionally complex. So it's like, as long as you do something that's consistent with your values and who you are, people will figure it out. That being said, I think it also is important to consider that as an artist, that we don't get so caught up in doing all these other things and all these projects that we forget what our main art actually is. You know, I was just at the DIY musician conference that CD Baby put on, doing a workshop on social media for people, and everyone wanted these hacks on social media. They wanted these shortcuts. And while I explained, like, yeah, it's great to know how to use social and to use it as a tool, like, you have to realize there is no shortcut. At the end of the day, you could have the best Facebook account in the world. You could have the best YouTube account in the world. But if your music sucks, then why even bother? Like you have to you have to make sure you still have something that's worth sharing, that's worth liking and following first and foremost. From that, everything else should kind of spring forward.
That's great. And I think the other thing is too, and I've had sort of limited experience with that, but I think, you know, you have to kind of trust in the curiosity of your audience. And so, like, for example, you know, with this podcast, I know that because people hear me on the podcast and they're like, who the hell is this chick? They're more likely to go to my website and listen to my music because they're curious to see who I am.
Absolutely.
And I wouldn't have had that introduction had I not had this podcast. Do I retain them as a fan? Well, that's really up to their own personal taste. And if they actually liked what they heard, or they were like, oh, this is shit. but at the same time, I got those eyes and ears. I got engagement simply because of having this other project out there, which again is reaching a market that my music may not normally tap into.
Yeah, I'm all about, like, finding unique ways to reach people, especially if you can connect with them in different ways. Like, music may not be the gateway into like a new fan or follower, but if they get there through some other means, why not? I mean, like, there was a number of years ago where I started thinking about my approach to social media and how, again, like me booking conventions, I wanted to differentiate ourselves than other bands. So I didn't just want to copy another band's strategy, like, oh, I'm going to share memes or cat videos or something like that. Like, that wasn't true to who we were. But I thought, you know what's really true to us is food. We love food. Like, we'll book entire tours around cities where we want to eat. Like, seriously, we played in St. Louis because Anthony Bourdain created this list of 13 places to eat before you die. And we decided we had to go to one of those places. So
that's awesome.
You know, to kind of, and we always talked about it, but that, you know, like on, joked about it on stage and our social. But then I thought, why not go to the source of like foodies, go to choose a channel that's dedicated to food. So I created a Yelp account and would write reviews of every place we hit up on tour. And as I did, I said, if you like this, I'm a musician. I eat out at restaurants all the time. Come check out my profile. There's a link and you can download a free song. That's all I did. And my first year of doing this, we had over 20,000 downloads. The following year, I was like, wow, that worked out really well. I'm going to step it up because I noticed that in Portland, Oregon, where we were based out of, my favorite restaurants weren't getting any love from the local media, especially food, like Asian food. They kind of wanted to be very central. So it was all like hipster downtown restaurants, not the food being prepared by, you know, our actual community, by immigrant families and that kind of thing. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to make my own food guide. So we created a list of our favorite places. I linked to it on my Yelp profile. And then I decided to take the same principles and move it offline. I printed copies of this guide and put them in restaurants around town. And I got window cling stickers for our 10 favorite restaurants where it said we're on the best of the best list for the slants and had our website. So all of a sudden,
oh, that's so
like,
smart.
People would
this.
Go to restaurants and like, the slants eat here? Like what? You know, and they would pick up the guide and they would look at the Yelp, and that spurred on another 45,000 downloads. And of course, many of those converted into album sales and attendees at our concerts too. And on top of that, I started getting free food everywhere I went. So I was like, this is a win-win for sure. And here's the thing. Like when I started telling other bands about this, because, you know, it's a small community, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to try using Yelp for my music. People are like, you're crazy. Why would you ever use Yelp for your music? And I'm like, I don't know. I like eating food and I want to find other people who like food because they probably listen to music. Again, we're complex beings. Like we're not one dimensional. We yet somehow we treat our fans as if they were. And we also treat our own music as if it were like, this is the only way we can market ourselves, or like, this is how we present ourselves. But the reality is like, you don't have to do that. You can do something that's much more interesting and compelling.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think that's so true also, that people get afraid that they're going to get pigeonholed. Like it's not, and obviously this is a silly example, but it's not as if people then expected the slants to come out with songs about food,
yeah.
You know, like it was, people were able to put two and two together. Like this is a band that does this kind of music, but they also happen to like this particular food, you know, like you're saying, it's like, it's not this sort of one dimensional, like you're going to be forever attached to a certain brand, or you have to therefore only market to a certain percentage of people, et cetera.
Yeah, just be your whole self. And, you know, you'll attract other people who will appreciate some facet of who you are, or even better, like your true fans, the people who are most loyal to you, who really identify with you. They're going to have much more in common with you than just like liking your music. They're going to be like, what? They like my music and my favorite restaurant and, you know, like, a certain fashion company or whatever it is that you're kind of known for, they'll start seeing all these elements of who you are and they'll just become much more loyal and feel much more connected with who you are.
That's so great. So we're running out of time, but I wanted to just ask quickly, what's, in addition to everything else, what's kind of coming down the pike for you for the rest of the year?
Well, right now I'm working on a couple of big projects. So my band is recording an EP right now. That's going to be due out by the end of the year. Then we're releasing a full length next year. I'm also co-writing the music for an upcoming Broadway musical that's based on my life and based on my band. Writing a memoir, and also just kind of producing this daily show called Music Business Hacks. So I still have another 160 episodes to go until the end of season one. So those things are eating up most of my time these days. But when I'm not doing any of those things, I travel as a speaker and performer. So that's kind of the next few months for me.
Excellent. Well, I think you're putting us all to shame, but in a good way. Can you share how people can find you on track you, social media, et cetera?
Sure. So all of my social media handles are at Simon the Tam, TAM. And folks can check out what I'm doing on my show at musicbusinesshacks.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Simon. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Again, special thanks to Simon for taking the time to be on the podcast. He was actually also featured in Access's 7 music-related podcasts you should be listening to right now. So again, it's Music Business Hacks is the name of his podcast. The website is musicbusinesshacks.com. You can also stalk him on social media at Simon the Tam, T-A-M as in Mary. So again, thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? So appreciative that you could all join us as we continue this journey into year 2. We're on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We would love it if you would follow, and we'll try to follow you back. I am your host, L. Ariel. You can find me and all my music and other videos and musings at lariel.com. That's lariel.com. I'm also on social media at lariel music. So wonderful to have you guys each and every week. So remember to just take good care, keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.